Welcome to the House of Brick Partner Podcast. The intent of this podcast is to share, educate, and advise listeners on what House of Brick sees with our important partners and clients. This is episode 2 on the important topic of Oracle audits. I am Bob Lindquist, and I'm speaking with Pam Fulmer, attorney at our partner Tactical Law Group. We also have Dave Welch, executive consultant at House of Brick, joining our conversation. So let's come back on the cloud policy, and then we'll move on. Pam, the cloud policy, contractual, not contractual. I mean, how is that usually positioned with Oracle customers, do you see?
So the cloud policy is actually not part of your contract. If you go into your contract, you know, you're not going to see that. And there's no mention of cloud. There's no mention of VMware or virtualization at all in your license agreement. But Oracle does have a policy. It's non-contractual, and it says on it, on its face, that it's non-contractual and that they can basically change it at any time. But, you know, and Dave can get into all the nitty-gritty of counting, you know, cores and, you know, all that. But basically it provides, you know, for how and where you can run Oracle in the cloud. And it's very limiting. And Oracle, even though it's not part of your contract, Oracle has basically provided the ability to do that. And they have never come back and said, you can't do it. Yeah. Now, you know, is there a possibility that they could change that sometime in the future? Yeah, there's a possibility. And there are legal arguments that you could make as to why they can't do that. But so far, we haven't actually seen them attempt to yank back that policy. It's been the opposite, actually.
Yeah, and I've seen, while we're talking about the cloud policy, I've seen it used as a tactic to make the customer think it's more expensive to put Oracle in a third-party cloud. If you use the cloud policy, it's going to cost twice as much if you put it using that cloud policy. Dave, in moving to a cloud like AWS or Azure, other public cloud providers, talk a little about dedicated hosts, bring your own license. How does that compare and contrast to the cloud policy?
Well, the cloud policy, first off, allows you in AWS and Azure only to license what we call by the drink. Meaning, unless you've got dedicated hardware, which most workloads are licensed or put up in the cloud on non-dedicated hosts, shared hosts, the cloud provider doesn't expose you to the server name and the core count underneath. So way back in October of 2008 at Oracle Open World, Oracle and AWS announced this cloud policy with a lot of fanfare. They've been selling with it now for 14 years. And they said, we'll just allow you to count vCPUs, the number of vCPUs assigned to any given VM. So that way you don't have to use traditional processor licensing where you would have to know the core count. The problem is people say, well, we don't want to do AWS maybe or Azure. We want to go someplace else. And it's like, you can't. Any other way that you do it, you're going to have to use the traditional contract and traditional processor licensing, which means that you're exposed to the named servers underneath your virtual machines, and you're going to have to license those servers the same way you do with processor-based licensing. So if you are in AWS or Azure or any other third-party cloud, and you have exposure to the hardware, you have dedicated hardware and you can see the hosts, you've got their IPs, their DNS names, then you license using traditional licensing. But you better have boundaries configured and you know, motion limitations so that your workloads stay just on the subset of the hardware that you have available and don't run all over the place. You have the same concerns for restricting your workloads only to authorized licensed hosts in a third-party cloud with dedicated hardware that you do on-prem.
Right. And like we like to say, you know, we have options, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a deeper architectural conversation. If anyone would like to speak to us about some of those details, we could certainly get into right. that at a later time. you know, I'm recalling, Dave, one of our first clients that we did an audit with, one of my clients here in the West.
That would have been before the dawn of time, Bob, but anyway.
Well, not that long. I've only been here 8 years, so, but maybe it was almost 6 or 7 years ago. As I recall, new CIO, right? Not a really huge IT staff, if you're starting to recall who this is.
I think, and I know who you're talking about.
You know, they previously had kind of, I don't want to say played around with some features in the environment. The CIO was really concerned about compliance, as well as they were moving to a new, you know, converged platform based on VMware. So when he got this notice, you know, you could tell he was, you know, he's a pretty confident guy, but this kind of scared him.
You're talking about audit notice when you say
the audit notice that the CIO got.
Sure.
He just wasn't sure, right? What was he supposed to do? Maybe there was some feature usage. Maybe there was a compliance gap. What do we see as the common assertions, like if advanced compression had been turned on once to try it out, or is it too easy to turn some of those things on and maybe they get false positives when they get audited? Talk a little about that and what we saw at that client and others.
Okay. Well, yeah. I can't remember the specifics of what we saw at that client because it's been multiple hundred audits since then. But I can tell you, and I think what I want to do in answering this question briefly, I want to avoid Oracle's non-contractual assertions that would inflate an audit claim. And I just want to talk about actual problems that do indeed have contractual liability. Right. Advanced compression is a common one, and not in order of importance, not in order of dollar amount impact, but people using advanced compression, especially on backup, where the DBAs have not been authorized by management to use it, and they may or may not be aware that it's a paid feature. Another one, not at all in order of priority, but using database enterprise edition features systemically, operationally, where people know they're using them, and maybe it is a standard edition database license. That can be a problem. The VMware and Hyper-V assertion that you have to license the entire thing aside, let's talk about organizations that have, say, 16 ESXi hosts for VMware, and they only wanted their databases to run on 4 of those, and maybe the system administration staff wasn't careful enough and opened the environment up, and so they have all 16 servers infected with a licensing liability as opposed to just the 4. We've seen clients that had a traditional Oracle database license, but they were doing software as a service and application hosting, proprietary application hosting, and didn't realize that their license only allowed them to use that software for their own internal business operations, unless they had a specific amendment from Oracle. And then the last one that I would share with you, and forgot what it was. So if it comes back to me later on, I'll tell you. But those are some examples of all too common liabilities that people incur when they're not watching. Pam, you may have some others that you've thought of.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you can tell based on Dave's answer that he sees a lot of these issues every day. I mean, we all do. And that means we also know, you know, ways, arguments that can be made that others that would just be in this for the first time wouldn't know.
And you walked into my next question, Pam. Continue.
Okay. And so that's something that we can really, you know, bring a value to the client. And we basically, you know, we do this every day. So we know the arguments, we know the playbook, we know, you know, what Oracle's next move is going to be. And so we develop strategies to combat that and, you know, to fight back and to actually provide arguments why, you know, certain liability, even if theoretically based on the license agreement, you know, you did incur a licensing obligation. why that should be let go by Oracle. And we've been pretty successful at that.
I remembered what the other one was. And it, I want to mention it because it's terribly common, all too common. Any frequency is too much and there's too much. And that is when somebody knows that they have software that is bundled. Maybe they've got database bundled with e-business suite. So instead of running it on a server that has a limited number of cores, they run it on a server that has 24 or 36 cores. And then they don't realize that they've done something that violated the bundle and caused the database and the middle tier to be fully licensable. And so now they're not just exposed on a limited number of cores, they're exposed on a very, very large server. That's just another example. We could go on, but that's probably sufficient to answer the question.
Yeah, well, I'm hearing both of you talk and thinking of other clients. They may have a compliance issue or some finding from an audit. Two of the biggest things I tend to hear about are Oracle saying they can solve and close the audit if they execute an unlimited license agreement, right? That's a common one. Probably more recently though is, you know, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, right? If you either buy, you know, an exorbitant amount of Oracle Cloud credits or you move your workloads into the Oracle Cloud, we can close this audit today, right? I see that commonly. Are those common things? And we have options to avoid those things, Pam. I think that's kind of what you're alluding to, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you both have raised this before. Oracle looks at audits, in my opinion, as sales events.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, if the customer would immediately make a big purchase, you know, the audit would most likely just go away. But, you know, really, you're just opening yourself up to problems in the future. You know, if you really do, in my experience, want to be the squeaky wheel, you want to be the difficult one, because believe me, if you're nice to Oracle and some of these other publishers, that doesn't mean they're not going to come back and hit you 2 years down the road. They will. As a matter of fact, the more easy of a target you are, the more you're basically, I think, guaranteeing a new visit, you know, shortly down the road. From your favorite software vendor. But so be the squeaky wheel, push back, know your contractual rights and, you know, stand on those rights. That's very important. And don't accept everything at face value that Oracle or Quest or Micro Focus or whoever tells you, you know, during an audit. Just because they say it doesn't mean it's true. The touchstone is your contract, and that's what you need to go back to. And then also think about kind of these various scenarios that we've talked about where you really don't know what options you might have. And so going it alone often is really, you know, quite problematic. And you're going to end up paying a lot of money, I think, that you wouldn't have had to if you would have hired, you know, competent folks that could come in and advise you on these issues. Right.
Pam just mentioned three vendors. Pam just mentioned three vendors that are making quite a name for themselves for making claims that have no merit in the client's current agreement.
Yeah. And my question related to what Pam was discussing, when our clients, particularly those that feel they have a good partnership, right, that Oracle's one of their best partners, I think, you know, when I first came on board, we were actually an Oracle partner, Dave, at that time, I believe, but they changed their partnering agreements where, as a partner, you're required to report non-compliance issues. Now, I think, you know, for over 20 years that you've been here at House of Brick, Oracle's technology has been great. There's been maybe some mergers and acquisitions that we could, you know, talk later about that may not be as great, but from a partnering perspective, has Oracle been partnering well with customers or partners?
I'm going to have to take off my shoes to count the number of C-level that have declared in scaled organizations, public, not-for-profit, private, for-profit, that have sworn off putting any incremental projects on Oracle, no matter extreme unbudgeted expense for dual training, slowing down project commitments that they had made to their business units already, dual licensing, just because they have arrived to categorize Oracle as their number one threat in IT. It's not a technical threat. They're understanding that the overhead of doing business with Oracle, because of the probability of audits and what previously had been unbudgeted time and money to deal with these audits, is just not worth it.
That brings us to the end of episode 2 on Oracle audits. Please check back soon for the next episode of our ongoing discussion on this important topic. Thanks for listening.